Hello, my name is Brian Novoselsky, Associate Editor with Drug Topics. Today I'm here with Miguel Rodriguez. Miguel is Executive Vice President and General Counsel for American Pharmacies, a member-owned purchasing cooperative for independent pharmacies with members in 38 states. He plays a leading role for American pharmacies in both legal affairs and legislative advocacy. He has been a major contributor to the content of pro-pharmacy bills passed in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and Michigan, and has testified before Congress, the Federal Trade Commission, and legislatures in several states. We are here today to talk with Miguel about important legal and legislative developments at the state level and how they affect independent pharmacy. So Miguel, for our first question, in our last podcast, we discussed how federal court decisions have sparked an increase in state legislation aimed at curbing PBM issues. What kinds of state laws are we seeing around the country?
Well, yeah, there's been just so many state laws and a huge variety of them. That probably comes from the fact that these PBM practices have gotten so bad in so many different areas that you just need a whole host of different laws, different types of laws to get passed to deal with them. I'll talk about some of the ones that are more prominent. There's been a lot of work on anti-steering laws. So if you think of a patient that comes into the store and maybe they've been a customer for 20 years, and then they get a letter from their PBM saying that they have to get their medicine from the mail order company or from a CVS store or something like that, that's basically the PBM steering the patient to a pharmacy that they own. And this is just an inherent conflict of interest. And there's been a lot of laws targeting these steering practices. So that's one thing. There's been a lot of what I would call a fundamental law of getting the PBM licensed and registered in the state. For a long time, they were not even subject to any formal oversight because there wasn't a law that required the PBM to be licensed to do business in a state in order to get that done. That's a simple thing. In and of itself, it doesn't change anything. But once you do that, then the Department of Insurance is now focused on, here's an entity that I have oversight over. I need to make sure that they're following other laws that the state might pass. And if they don't follow these other laws, then there's a huge hammer that the state will have. Of course, they could usually fine them for failing to follow the law, but they can also revoke the license, which would be the death sentence for the PBM in that state. So, which is a huge amount of power for the state to be given to really ensure that the laws are being followed. So there's been quite a few of states that have passed laws like that. Spread pricing is a big one. This spread pricing is basically where the PBM is paying the pharmacy much less than they're getting paid by a health plan for the same service. And they keep that spread and put it in their own pocket. And that spread pricing leads to a huge amount of waste in the system. And it's gotten to really terrible, large amounts of money. I think the state of Ohio was one of the first to really uncover this practice of spread pricing. And once it was uncovered, that practice was banned, the state saved millions and millions of dollars by banning that practice, money that was then utilized and provided to enhance care, of course, savings to the state, savings to the patient, and an opportunity to provide better compensation to the pharmacy. So that spread pricing ban is a tremendous tool. A lot of states are passing that around the country. Transaction fees and clawbacks of all sorts of kinds, that's been something that's been passed. And that's one of the first areas of legislation. Our organization, American Pharmacies, was involved with passing a lot of this legislation as well. A lot of transaction fee bans, clawback bans, anti-steering bans, things that I'll be discussing probably throughout this conversation. But those transaction fees, after those bans have been placed, we've seen them really become more minimal across the country, and those states that have been successful in getting those laws passed. We're also seeing that those are opportunities to prevent other bad practices that are popping up. We're seeing discount cards being utilized in the commercial insurance space, where they're effectively charging a transaction fee to the pharmacy. And so I foresee these transaction fee bans to become more important for those states that have passed them. So I highly encourage any state that hasn't done it to get that passed. So there's a lot of audit laws. I mean, the amount of audits that pharmacies are required to go through are just tremendous. And these are not audits of accusing the pharmacy of fraud, waste, and abuse at all. This is just a typical audit that reviews some claims and try and while certainly the concept of an audit is fine, I don't think you'd find any pharmacy disagree that audits can be a good thing that should be done, and they're willing to stand by whatever high standard. But unfortunately, those audits have become abused as almost a profit center by the pharmacy benefit manager to uncover the most minimal clerical error and utilize that to get all the money paid on the claim back. And even when the patient got the right drug, it was prescribed correctly and dispensed at the right amount, and the pharmacy got paid the correct amount. Even with all of that being true, the PBMs are using audits to get the money back from the pharmacy. So this has really been a practice that's been abused, and there's been a lot of states that have reformed that practice. One of the newest, I think, trends that we're seeing is probably the most important. For so long, pharmacies have been, I'm going to say, a little bit shy and timid in bringing up the issue of reimbursement. I think no one wants to talk about how much they get paid, and I think they're probably concerned that they may be coming off as undeserving of a discussion about reimbursement. But I think that shyness is starting to go away. I think the reimbursements to pharmacies have gotten so bad, where there's so much of a pharmacy's business is now getting reimbursed at less than the cost of acquisition of a drug, that discussion is just, it needs to take place. And there's just no getting around it anymore. And so I think this is the newest and very necessary wave in state PBM reform law is reimbursement reform. Most of that has come in the form of a reimbursement based on NADAC plus a Medicaid fee-for-service dispensing fee as the goal. I think we're seeing other components though on top of that, and this is where I would say the conversation needs to go next, which is NADAC plus fee-for-service is fantastic. It would be a very big improvement over the current system, but even if that's paid, that only gets you at cost. Basically, it covers your cost of the medicine and it covers the cost of your overhead, but it provides no compensation for the fact that you're running a business. And so I think that conversation needs to continue to evolve to talk about an additional amount of compensation to cover the fact that these are business owners trying to run a business. But I think we're going to see a lot more of that across the country in terms of state reform that's going to involve increasing or at least setting the floor, a baseline of what a reasonable reimbursement might be.
So moving over to kind of challenges on the state side, different federal appeals courts are issuing conflicting opinions on the validity of PBM reform legislation passed in different states. Is this complicating enforcement of state PBM laws?
Yes, unfortunately it is. And the biggest right now, the biggest battle that's going on in the courts in terms of state PBM reform law comes out of a Rutledge decision, which was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that dealt with whether or not a state could enforce their laws on ERISA plans. And unfortunately, just to back up a little bit, the Rutledge case dealt specifically with an Arkansas law that dealt with maximum allowable cost reform. So it dealt with a law on there. But states have, as we just discussed, have been passing laws on a whole host of other issues like any willing pharmacy, steering, transaction fee bans, a whole host of other issues, not just maximum allowable cost. And so what PCMA has tried to do is to say that the Rutledge decision was limited just to maximum allowable cost. And all these other state laws dealing with steering and other issues were not covered by that Rutledge decision. And so the courts have been trying to evaluate this dividing line, this boundary between what is and isn't permissible in terms of state laws that are touching upon in any way ERISA plans. The same is true for Medicare Part D. So right now there's two schools of thought on that. There was a case that came out of North Dakota called PCMA versus Wiebe that dealt with a really comprehensive PBM reform law. And that court, which was the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, said that all of that was permissible. The North Dakota could re-regulate ERISA, Med D plans in all of these host of areas, was very permissive. But then there was another case that just came out called PCMA versus Mulready, dealing with an Oklahoma law. And that court took the opposite view and took a very narrow view of what a state could do. That case is currently in the middle of an appeal to the US Supreme Court. American Pharmacies, along with several other national pharmacy organizations, have filed a brief in support of the state of Oklahoma, hoping that the US Supreme Court takes that case and provides the necessary clarity to resolve these differences between these two circuit courts. Because the last thing we need to have is a part of our country where these PBM reform laws can be enforced, and then another part of the country where they can't be. That's just not fair. And it leads to a whole host of confusion across the country. So hopefully that'll get resolved by the US Supreme Court very soon. We're going to probably find out actually within the next month or two whether or not the US Supreme Court is going to take that case.
Moving aside to American Pharmacy's role in the state advocacy. So American Pharmacies has a long history of advocacy engagement at the state level. It started in Texas. How has that expanded over the years?
Yeah, well, it's been a great journey, and I'm happy to say I was part of that journey. Our Vice President of Government Affairs, Michael Wright, has tremendous resource to this organization. He's a long history of experience, and he has been instrumental in expanding the scope of our state advocacy from Texas to New Mexico to Michigan, Arizona, and it continues to expand to this day. As our organization has grown and we have membership across the country, we've been listening for anyone that has a need in the advocacy space and doing what we can to help. And so every state is different. It's really interesting, and I've learned quite a bit as I help support that advocacy work in terms of drafting bills and reviewing bill language and supporting this legislative effort. Every state's different. They have a different political climate in terms of who's in control of Congress, Democrats or Republicans, a different set of priorities in the state, different amount of money in the state available, a different process, just a different way of doing things. Some are very informal, some are highly formal. And then a different community of need in terms of what is the biggest pain point in a particular state. So it's really what I like about what American Pharmacies has been able to do is because we've have experience in a wide variety of areas, we're able to have a little bit of perspective, a little more perspective from a higher level to see what trends are placing. We get our experience of what has worked and failed to work in these various battles and bring that experience to bear to these new battles that we're trying to fight. So we are fully engaged in a whole host of jurisdictions around this country. And I think it's also a testament to the change in the mindset of the pharmacy owner from being passive about what's happening to them to decide that they want to take part and advocate for their business. And so they're looking for anyone that could help them with some expertise and point them in the right direction and give them some advice on what can be accomplished and how to accomplish it, because it's much more complicated than that Saturday morning cartoon of how a bill becomes the law. There's so much more involved that goes on behind the scenes that is out of everyone's view. And so you need a little bit of that. You need the passion, and you need the communication with your membership, the grassroots organization, but you also need to understand where the pain point is as a bill is being created and needs to go through that process. Tennessee passed some phenomenal bills the last few sessions, and that is in part because they have a pharmacy, big independent pharmacy connection with leadership in that state. So both chambers in the Tennessee Congress had a pharmacist or someone who was a family member of an independent pharmacy owner in power. And so that is a tremendous help. And it speaks to the need for what I hope is the even next wave, which is to get pharmacy owners to run for office and get in office, because nothing helps educate. When they're in office, then all of a sudden that person, whoever it is, becomes the pharmacy expert for the entire legislature. So everyone will go to them first to find out whether a bill is worthwhile or not. And so getting pharmacy owners in office would be a tremendous next step.
Awesome. We can dive a little deeper into that and kind of how the members are involved. Obviously, American Pharmacies has been in the advocacy space for quite some time. You're not new to it, and you've seen some successes. How important are your members in all of these legislative victories?
They play the central role. They are the star of the show. Michael Wright, who, as I mentioned, is a tremendous asset. I help in every way I can. And it's great to build relationships for either Michael or I to build relationships with legislators. But any of that pales in comparison with when it's the pharmacy owner from someone's district coming in to talk to them. That is the star. And I've seen so many pharmacy owners that are members of ours just grow in terms of initially being a little tentative and timid in terms of how they interact with the legislator, to becoming very comfortable and free to voice concerns, be honest and articulate the concerns that they have. And if you are ever see any committee hearings where they are being heard by an entire committee of legislators, doesn't matter blue or red, Dem or Republican, you're going to have a whole panel on a committee that is just wrapped in attention with what these pharmacy owners are saying and the tremendous testimony that they give. That happens in private too. So when they're back in the office, they're getting just as much special attention. So the pharmacy owner is central to it. They put a real face to the issue. They can talk about their patients because they're so close to them, and those are just tremendous stories that they can give that someone like I cannot give that same story, no matter how much I try. So getting involved is so important. And the great thing about independent pharmacy is there is not a district in this country, state or federal, that doesn't have independent pharmacy owners in it. And so that's something that the PBMs can't do. They cannot bring a local constituent to a legislator, because these are giant corporations that don't have presence in every community. So it's definitely the big advantage that independent pharmacy has in advocacy is business owners in communities serving patients. And that is just a tremendous advantage in an advocacy standpoint. So they're central.
Pivoting back to American Pharmacy's role in kind of all this advocacy on the state level, what kind of support do you provide your members to help them be better advocates?
Right. So one of the things we do is we try to provide education and training on how to interact with a legislator. One of the things we do is try to have them invite them into the store to see them in action, certainly to visit their local legislator, to even something that sounds so simple, but it's very effective, which is to simply write a letter. We have a platform called Voter Voice, which provides an easy mechanism for our members to find out who represents them and to communicate with them. So for those that are willing, we have those sort of a kit, I would say, to help educate them in how to advocate for their profession. For those that are willing to go and actually show up in the legislature and testify, that is just so powerful, as I just mentioned. And so we for those that we ask to do that and that are willing to do it, we help them prepare for their testimony by making sure they're comfortable, that they're getting all the points they need to be raised out. Sometimes there's time limits, so we need advise them to make sure their remarks are timed out and ready to go, well rehearsed, and but still authentic, and to make sure that authenticity remains true to them. And then, of course, in the legislation process, what is the problem that they're facing? That's really where it all starts. So we need their feedback, our members' feedback, into what problems they're facing, because then that's we need the next step is whether or not that problem can be solved through legislation. And then if so, how do you draw it up? And what committee do you go to? And all these different decisions that need to be made. Who's going to sponsor this bill? And how do you educate the sponsor? So this is I would consider a very close relationship with our members. And we find our members appreciate it. Not everybody wants to be involved. Some people just don't have time for it or don't feel they have time for it. Some, as I've said, there's been a bigger awakening, and I feel like they're more willing and ready than ever to become involved in any way. And so it's just a great rewarding feeling for me in particular to say to be able to have this conversation with the pharmacy owner where they can articulate the problems they're suffering, and Michael and I can help articulate possible solutions to that. Now, this is that there's nothing easy about the process. Just getting to that step means that you've just begun the battle, but it's still tremendous. And when we've had great success over the years. I mean, we've passed so many bills across the country, certainly in Texas, where we've been active for the longest, that go back for years, for over a decade worth of laws that we've passed basically every session. And so each one of them has been a unique battle, and so we couldn't be happier with the success we've had. But it's always we're never done. There's always a new problem and solution that we need to figure out how to solve.
Awesome. So I have one more question for you, kind of looking outside of the scope of American pharmacy specifically. So it's hard to experience consistent success all on your own. What other groups do you partner with in your advocacy efforts?
There's been more and more, and it's been great because it's more than what who you'd think. Certainly, we have worked with the National Community Pharmacists Association, American Pharmacists Association. They both have very good active advocacy efforts and resources. That's what they're built to do, and they do a great job. So we've worked with them. We've worked with many state associations across the country. And then there's been other organizations. Like there's one called Pharmacists United for Truth and Transparency. It's a pure advocacy independent pharmacy group that's been very fantastic in terms of communicating the issues that are and articulating them and making it really accessible for the members of the public to understand these issues because they're really technical issues that are hard to communicate sometimes. They've been doing a great job of that and doing a great job of focusing efforts in particular states. So we partner with those guys. Organizations that you wouldn't expect, like, or you might not think of, like the oncologists, Community Oncologists Alliance, COA, phenomenal advocacy program. Again, a very well-respected community of physicians and that are cancer doctors. they are getting hit hard by the PBMs, and they're very much allies in this fight. Rheumatologists as well. These are people that are trying to serve their patients, and the PBMs are dictating to them what drug the patient should take. And so it's just totally a backward situation. And they're seeing that affect patient care and aren't happy about it, and are tremendous advocates for their patients and partners with pharmacists. The chain drug stores, National Association of Chain Drug Stores, they recently parted ways with CVS as one of their members, even though CVS is a chain drug store. I feel that since CVS left that organization, the organization has been more free to advocate for the issues of pharmacies than they had been before. And so they're a tremendous organization with a lot of great assets. Now, the other groups, and this will be true in any part of the country, are these regional drug stores. So or regional grocery stores. So often the local chain grocery store has a pharmacy in it, and they may only have 20 to 100 stores in a region, but they're getting hit hard by the PBMs too. And they also, since they're grocery stores, they all often have a tremendous amount of goodwill in the community. People love them. And so they're tremendous allies to have in the fight too.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me.